Let me say that I think it's best, you should do really, truly whatever is right for you as a student. Every student is different. But I don't recommend printing out the slideshows and then writing in the margins of that as your notes, unless it truly, truly helps you for some reason. I really recommend just old school note taking on blank paper, like most of you look like you're preparing for. You'll also notice once we get in this that almost none of my slides has very much text on it. They're almost all pictures. Pictures are important, that's one reason, but also you already have access to all of these. And so writing down text that's on slides would be a total waste of your time, right? You already have a copy of it on the website. Despite that fact, though, if I have text on the slides, I notice that people will stop listening to me and just write down the text because they think what's on a slide is important. And so I don't give you that chance by eliminating text for the most part. Some slides will have a little bit of text, but most don't. Think of this set of notes you're beginning here as a rough draft, like I was talking about earlier. To do well on the exams, you need to refine these notes at home by listening to the recordings. And doing that efficiently means you should know where you are in the slideshow at all times. You can tell by looking that we're on slide whatever by the red number. But I'll try to always announce that so that you can follow along in the recordings. It'll make it a lot easier, though, if you actually draw a line in your notes every time I change slides and write down your slide number so you can refine them at home. The opening chapter is kind of a catch-all introductory chapter. Of course, this is biology, which is the study of life, so it's appropriate to talk about what life is, which, you know, we have a feeling for what life is, but it's kind of hard to give a concise definition of. Well, one thing I want to say, though, is that in the universe there are objects, and any given object in the universe belongs to one of three categories. There's three kinds of things, one of which is living things. What are the other two, though? Well, I said living.
Non-living and dead.
Yes, non-living and dead. Those are the other two. Those are not the same thing, notice. A dead thing once did live and is no longer. A non-living thing never was alive, like a rock. All right. So any given object is one and only one of those three categories. But what is it that are the living that makes up the living things? What does it mean to be alive? Yeah, that's as close as we can get to, I think, to a short definition of life. Metabolism is something we'll talk a lot more about as we go through the term. But let me tell you right now, oh man, there they are. I knew there had to be some good ones. Let me give you a definition of that right now. Metabolism is the sum of all the chemical reactions that are occurring in an organism. But metabolism really is life. Life is a process, a chemical process, really a set of chemical processes. All of the chemical reactions that are occurring in organisms is what life is. And that's the difference between a living thing and a dead thing. The dead thing is no longer metabolizing. Might be the same structures that are there until it starts to rot, but it's no longer undergoing metabolism if it's dead. So really life is just chemistry, the chemistry of metabolism. Still, though, what this slide shows us is that living things or organisms can be characterized by these seven major things that organisms have in common, some of which are characteristics that non-living things have as well. But non-living things won't have all seven of these major characteristics. Only living things will. Now, I've said living things, I've said organisms. Those are roughly interchangeable terms. But it's important to understand what an organism is. I mean, yes, it is a living thing, but what is it that actually defines an organism? I mean, for instance, since we're in the middle of a pandemic, is a coronavirus or any virus a living thing? Is it an organism? It is not. Why isn't it? It's not alive, despite what you hear on TV all the time. You'll hear things like, well, this kills the virus. The virus was not alive to begin with. You can deactivate a virus, which means you just change its molecules. It's only a couple molecules big, a virus. It's far from an organism. It doesn't have a metabolism. It's not undergoing reactions. But it obviously interacts with living things, right? Which is why it causes the problems we've been having. So yes, it's not an organism. What is, structurally speaking, the bare minimum requirement for being an organism?
One or more cells.
Right. To officially be an organism, you have to have at least one cell. Cells are the little bags in which metabolism occurs, in which life occurs. And a virus isn't close to having a cell. It's much smaller than even the smallest cells. So that's what an organism is. There, in terms of how many cells there are two big batches of organisms. There are the unicellular organisms of the world, which have always and continue to be by far the majority of organisms. It seems like there's a lot of people, and there are for people, but the number of unicellular organisms out there is enormous. And they've always been, by far, the most organisms alive. But there's also multicellular organisms, which we are examples of, right? We are animals. Animals, in general, are multicellular organisms. So are plants. Most fungi are multicellular. Anything that's made out of more than one cell, as an individual, is a multicellular organism. And those are the ones that we pay most attention to simply because they're macroscopic. For one thing, we can see them. But also, we just relate to them because we're fellow multicellular organisms. Anyway, any organism, regardless of being unicellular or multicellular, if it's alive, it will have all seven of these characteristics. Let's quickly go through these, or hopefully quickly go through these. Clockwise. Response to the environment. Well, you already know that's true, right? Living things don't live in isolation from their environment. They're continuously responding to the things that are happening around them. They have to in order to remain alive. If they were passive, then the changes in the environment would kill them eventually. And that still happens if they can't respond appropriately. But there is response to the environment in all organisms, even the simplest. Reproduction is listed here. Now, that does not mean that an organism that does not successfully or willingly reproduce fails to be an organism. I have chosen not to reproduce. That does not mean that I'm not an organism. So it's talking about the capacity for reproduction here. And reproduction, by the way, is one of these examples that is true not only of living things, but of some non-living things. There are crystals that can reproduce, for instance. There are certain proteins that can reproduce.
Like prions?
Yes, and they cause their own problems, like mad cow disease. So don't think that only living things have these characteristics. It's just that only living things have all seven of these characteristics. Growth and development is listed next. Two things, really, but it's lumped into one. Growth obviously refers to an increase in size. That occurs for all organisms, even unicellular organisms. A bacterium is a typical unicellular organism. And most unicellular organisms are created by a cell splitting into two. Well, obviously, if that happens, the original cell splitting into two is not going to produce two cells that are as big as the original one immediately, right? So even a newly created cell, which is half as big as the original cell that split, needs to grow. But for multicellular organisms, growth mostly refers to creation of new cells. So we all started out as a unicellular organism called a zygote, but we are no longer unicellular. We are multicellular. We're not one human-sized cell, though. We are many, many cells. And approximately how many, many? You have a feel for this? Yes, 100 trillion, roughly. Depends on the size of the adult human. 100 trillion cells. Now, those are your own cells. Those are the cells that have your DNA, that make up what you call your body. But you're actually vastly outnumbered. In the space that you call you, for every one of your own cells, there's between 10 and 100 bacteria that live in and on you. So most of what you call your body is, in terms of cell numbers of cells, is bacteria. Anyway, that's growth, getting bigger. Development refers to changes along the way. So we're not only no longer one zygote, one cell, we're trillions of cells, but we also are made up of many different kinds of cells because they have developed differently. There are neurons and fingernail cells and all kinds of stuff, right? That's development. Energy processing is something we're going to spend a great deal on in Unit 3. To remain alive, organisms have to continuously process energy. And as we'll talk more about, they have to continuously exchange materials and energy with the surroundings. So that's an important hallmark of life, as is regulation. Regulation refers to controlling things within limits, controlling variables. There's all kinds of different variables, which we'll be talking about, but regulation refers to keeping variables within tolerable limits. If they get outside of those limits, it kills the organism. This is concisely described by the word homeostasis, a word that means staying the same. It's really a misnomer because no organism stays the same. Organisms are continuously changing to a certain extent as they live. But homeostasis specifically refers to a maintenance of a relatively stable internal environment in an organism. So we do this with all kinds of variables. We don't let our blood pressure get too high or too low, or we die. Same with temperature and pH and all kinds of other variables. That's homeostasis, part of regulation. We'll talk about how that happens a little bit later. Order is next. All organisms have a pretty high degree of order. It's not always obvious, like this middle of this flower. It's not necessarily geometric order like this, but it's a highly ordered set of structures in any organism. Even organisms that seem to have no pattern to them. This is another example, by the way, of one of these characteristics that some non-living things have, right? There's crystals, again, are very highly ordered, but they're not alive. And then the last one at the top is evolutionary adaptation, which is a phrase that we should pay attention to both words from, one at a time. Adaptation, that's the noun form. The verb is adapt. What? Not in biology, but just in everyday terms, what does adapt mean?
To environment.
To change to one's environment or situation.
Yes. And by environment, that simply means the conditions. Correct. To adapt means to change, but to adjust, specifically change in a way that is suitable for those conditions. Right? That's why we call the things you plug into the wall for your electronic devices adapters. It adapts the electrical conditions, AC, alternating current, into DC, which is what the device needs. So you're making an adjustment that's appropriate for the surroundings. That's true for biological adaptation as well. Adaptation refers to an increase in what we call fitness. The fitness refers to how well-suited that individual or that species is to the set of conditions in which that species lives. Now, there's all kinds of different situations, environments that different species live in. But if a species is well-adapted, that means that species is well-suited for living where it does live. That's adaptation just by itself. What about evolution? Which is the noun form of the verb evolve. What does evolve mean? Well, I mean just in general, not in biology, but it just means change, yes. That's really all that evolution means, change. And you're right about the importance of over time. Evolution is a major topic in Bio 182 if you go on. We'll talk about it a little bit here. But it's important to realize that individuals do not evolve.
Populations.
Right. Populations, which are subsets of species, evolve between generations. So it's between generations when the evolution happens, because that's when the genetic makeup gets shuffled. Aided by mutation, yes. But evolution is simply a change in that genetic makeup in a population. As you'll learn in 182, that can happen in any of three major ways. But that simply refers to a change. It doesn't necessarily have to, evolution doesn't necessarily have to be adaptive. The genetic makeup can change in such a way that the fitness goes down, making those new members of the population less fit.
Like with dog breeds.
Yes, that's a good example. And for certain breeds, yes.
Yeah. But like problems for like some shorter leg dogs.
Yeah, inbreeding problems, and yes, that's a good example. So the reason I bring that up is that I usually mention Darwin when we talk about evolutionary adaptation, because he's one of the most recognized scientific names in the world. I mean, you don't have to have taken biology courses to know about Darwin and the link to evolution. But Darwin is not actually famous for evolution. Darwin's famous for being the first to come up with a way to describe how evolution can happen adaptively. And so of those three ways that evolution can happen that you'll learn in Bio 182, the only one of those that reliably increases adaptation is what Darwin is famous for. What is that mechanism called?
Natural selection.
Natural selection, exactly. That's what Darwin is famous for, explaining how evolution can lead to increased fitness over generations. And I'll give you some more information about that as we go in different slides. But let's move on to slide 2. And talk about what's happening here. This is a hierarchy. A hierarchy is a nested arrangement of things, right? Kind of like an outline is, where you have big steps that contain smaller steps that contain smaller steps and so on. This hierarchy is called the hierarchy of biological organization. It's a hierarchy of how living things are arranged, or at least arranged by humans. We're the ones really doing the arranging. We're making up these categories, in other words. But I'm going to talk about this from small to large, starting on the bottom right corner with atoms. Atoms is one level in that hierarchy of biological organization. Now, atoms are very, very tiny things, but they are not the tiniest things. There are levels below atoms. But they're not really... Once you're below the level of atoms, you're not so much in biology anymore as physics. So it's not to say they're not important. That's just why we're stopping here at, or we're starting at atoms. And we'll have a lot to say more about atoms coming up. You'll find that this course is just as much a chemistry course as it is a biology course, because the big difference between 181 and 182 is the scale that we're studying things at. 181 is cell biology. We're not going to go outside of the cell other than mentioning it here. The whole term is going to be what happens inside cells. 182 is everything bigger than the cell. Well, what happens inside cells? Chemistry. So that's why this is going to seem like a chemistry course. Anyway, atoms is one level by itself. Atoms of different types can combine to form more complex structures called molecules, another level. And by the way, when we go up in levels, we encounter what are called emergent properties. To emerge means to come out into the open. Emergent properties refers to the fact that in this hierarchy, as you go up in levels, the higher levels will have some properties that the lower levels don't have. For instance, just to tell you right away, atoms are not alive, and neither are molecules. Eventually we'll get to the cell level, though, and now it's alive. That's a property that the lower levels don't have. That's an example of an emergent property. Okay, so anyway, atoms form molecules. Molecules, then, of different types, combine to more complex structures called organelles. A word that literally means little organs. Because by analogy with our macroscopic body, they are like organs within our body, but in the cell. Organelles are subcellular, as atoms and molecules are, which simply means they're smaller than the cell. But they function like little organs because they're doing a specific job, like the liver as an organ does in your body. And these include things that you might have heard about, like mitochondria and endoplasmic reticulum, things we'll survey later. But that's the next level. Organelles of different types then make up a cell. It's the next level. And now we're finally at life. Right? You're not an organism until you get to the cell. Those other things are just structures. I should mention also that for the vast majority of organisms, which are the unicellular organisms, the cell level, which we're at right now, and the organism level, which we'll get to later after skipping these, would be the same level, right? A bacterium is one cell, but that's also the individual organism. So unicellular organisms don't have these next few steps, but multicellular organisms do. Cells of various types within an organism make up more complex structures called tissues. And different kinds of organisms have different categories of tissues. For instance, we vertebrates have four kinds of tissues: epithelial tissue, connective tissue, nervous tissue. Which one did I not say? Epithelial tissue, nervous tissue, connective tissue, and muscle tissue. Plants have tissues as well. They're just different categories, and so on. But multicellular organisms in general have tissues. Tissues, then, of different types, make up more complex things called organs. Organs by itself is one level. They've lumped two together here. And those are things that are familiar to you with your own body. You know, like the skin is an organ, the heart is an organ, and so on. Multiple organs combine into more complex things called organ systems, which in our body are represented by 11 organ systems: reproductive system, respiratory system, circulatory system, and so on. And then however many organ systems there are in that species combined make up the next level, which is the overall organism. Okay, so that should be pretty familiar to you. The next level above that, and this is, we're well into the 182 topics here, but I'll get through this before we get back to the cells. The next level is a population. A population is all of the organisms of the same type living in a particular place. All right? So just a specific species of tree, for instance, all of them in that same area make up a population. A community, which is the next level up, is different because even though it's the same place as the population, what's different is that the community includes all of the species living there, not just that one species. Right. And then above that is ecosystem. And how does ecosystem differ from community? Well, it would be reasonable, though wrong, to think that a community is a group of populations, which it is, and therefore an ecosystem must be a group of communities, but that's not right. Because this is all the same place, really. The population, the community, the ecosystem, all the same space. The population is just the one species of interest in that space. The community is all the species in that space. The ecosystem is the same space, but it includes the community, which is all the organisms, plus all of the non-living things that are there as well. In other words, for instance, the ecosystem includes the rocks and the air and the water, whereas the community does not, because they're not organisms. That leaves only the biggest one, which is the biosphere, which is a continuously changing in size level because it has to be adjusted to contain all of the known organisms in it. Keeps getting bigger because we keep finding, especially bacteria, living in places that we just were convinced would be impossible to live at. So it is a sphere because so far we only have definite knowledge of living things on Earth, and Earth is a sphere. But the biosphere is not the entire planet. It's spherical, but the biosphere is a hollow sphere with a thickness to its walls, to its wall. That's that thickness that keeps getting bigger because we keep finding, you know, the inside wall is how deep we can go and still find living things. The outside wall of the wall is how far out into the atmosphere we can go and still find living things. Now, just for mathematical probability alone, it's almost certain that there's a hell of a lot of life out there besides Earth life. But even though that makes sense to assume scientifically, we can't include it in the biosphere until we have proof that it exists. That's not likely, by the way, because even though it's almost certain that there's life out there, it's also very probable that we'll never come into contact with any of it because of the immense distances involved between these scatterings of life throughout the enormous universe. But if we ever do, we'll have to greatly expand the biosphere at that point. It won't be spherical anymore. I don't know what we'll call it then if it happens. But the biosphere includes all living things. All right, to three now. The picture the photograph that's in this box represents an ecosystem, as I defined it a little bit ago. This is a specific example, but the example doesn't matter. The point here is that for any given ecosystem, or at least almost all ecosystems on the surface, which are most ecosystems, there is a throughput of energy. Energy flows through an ecosystem, meaning energy enters and energy leaves. Whereas for materials, as opposed to energy, things made out of matter, there is a recycling of that matter within the ecosystem. Now, that's not perfect, of course. There's some leakage of matter between ecosystems, especially involving the atmosphere. But more or less, materials stay within an ecosystem, whereas energy flows through. And as when, you know, for all the ecosystems that are on the surface of the Earth, the energy comes in as sunlight. It doesn't stay as sunlight, though, which is just one type of energy. Energy becomes transformed and transferred. Transforming means that it's churned into different kinds of energy, like from sunlight to chemical energy, for instance. Transfer means the energy is moved from one object to another, whether it's one living thing to another, or a non-living thing to a non-living thing, or a non-living thing to a dead thing, anything. Eventually, though, the energy leaves the ecosystem as heat, which is not indicated in this picture, but that's what happens. The materials, on the other hand, move around within objects of the ecosystem, and not necessarily living objects. The body that you call your body is not the same body you had a week ago. It's made up of different atoms, some of which were in non-living things last week. You're always rebuilding your body. You build it the same way, which is why it looks the same day to day, but it's not made out of the same stuff. It's made out of largely what you take in as food and other things that you're exposed to in the environment. But that's just one way in which these materials get recycled over and over. You can see that in slide 4 as well. Sunlight is coming in, transformation and transferring of energy, and then eventually leaves us heat. Let's see. How time is it? What's the real time? Looks like it's time to quit. Right, we stop at 3:15, right? Never be afraid to stop me if I lose track of time. Or if you have another class, never be afraid to just get up and leave. You don't have to ask.